This is an ABC podcast.
When did you last watch The Machine That Goes Bing? Monty Python, of course. It's also under Monty Python Hospital Sketch in YouTube, worth looking at today. Still relevant, showing the gap between high-tech R&D and the poor patient languishing there, wondering what's going on, even being told to avoid gender questions about baby, and remembering some news item about a breakthrough in the lab and why the doctors seem to know nothing about it. Then listen to Dr. Ursula Sampson-Daly, a psychologist of distinction, one of our top five scientists a couple of years ago at the ABC, and here speaking at the Powerhouse Museum during National Science Week.
We've probably all heard the phrase bench to bedside. It's the idea that research done in a lab gets used to meaningfully shape the care of patients by the bedside. This conjures up an image of wonderfully earnest scientists beavering away in labs, having their eureka moments, then rushing next door to where a patient lies, ready and waiting to benefit from the implementation of this new knowledge. The bench-to-bedside ideal captures the essence of research translation, the understanding that research is vital to improving care, and that care is best delivered on the basis of solid evidence. As a clinical psychologist and a researcher, this evidence-to-practice juggle plays out in my work on a daily basis. With my scientist hat on, I know that the adolescent cancer patients I work with are vulnerable to mental health issues, and that there are proven benefits to regularly assessing their distress and offering evidence-based treatments to help. However, when I put on my hardy clinical boots and step onto the hospital wards, I also know that there are a lot of challenges that, in practice, can complicate delivering this care. For example, many of my patients live hundreds of kilometres away from the hospital. So are they really going to come back to have a face-to-face session with me after cancer treatment's done? The clinician researcher in me figures that we might need to consider tailoring our evidence-based treatments, maybe using online methods, bring the help directly to the young people in the comfort of their own homes. As a research study, it's instantly messier. But as a plan to roll out a treatment program that meets the actual needs of these young people, I'd say it's a better bet. In reality, there's often quite a gulf between the scientists conducting early phase lab research and the clinicians on the ground. For one thing, the increasingly cutthroat world of academic research doesn't make much space for clinical work. To stay competitive, researchers need to focus on publishing papers and getting grants. Though valuable, the sort of work involved in research translation is time-consuming. It also doesn't necessarily lead to the sort of metrics that are currently prized by academic institutions, those publication grant counts and grant dollars. This means that researchers are almost disincentivized from investing time and energy into real-world research translation. This results in a staggering loss of potential. Data show that on average, it takes 17 years for just 14% of our research efforts to make it into clinical practice. On the other side of the fence, we have our health professionals. Doctors, nurses, psychologists, dietitians, social workers, etc. These clinicians are busy. They have patients to look after, tests to order, and reports to write. And while healthcare professionals are obliged to keep up to date with research as part of professional development, few will have the capacity within a full-time clinical post to craft and lead research studies. This results in a loss of information at the other end. When you're doing science in isolation, in well-controlled lab conditions with perfect parameters, you can distill processes down to their purest forms. You can afford to exclude outliers, withdraw wayward specimens, or exclude participants with too many problematic comorbidities. But when you're seeing real patients at the same time, the reality of all that messiness, all those unanswered question marks, necessarily follows you back into the lab. This means clinician researchers can examine the black box of the health system's wickedest problems in a very grounded way. Another thing I spend a lot of time thinking about is how we can do better at having the tricky end-of-life conversations with young people with serious illnesses like cancer. Wearing my fancy research fedora, I can tell you that there is good evidence that talking about end-of-life issues does not greatly increase young people's anxiety. That, in fact, it can lead to young people feeling more heard, having their pain better managed, getting to make meaningful decisions about how they want to spend their time, and importantly, can result in them having to endure fewer intensive, aggressive, painful procedures close to the end of their lives. I can also tell you that we know that currently, dying adolescents are not getting to have these conversations often enough or early enough. This stuff matters. And of course, the research is vital. But it's only when I slip back into the muddy trenches of the clinical world that I can also tell you where the real gaps lie, the hurdles that stop us from having these important conversations. From my experience working alongside many amazing, highly skilled clinicians, I can tell you that they already know that this stuff matters. What they don't always know is how to pick the right moment or the best words to let a young person know as gently and honestly as possible that their life might be shorter than they've always imagined. What we don't yet know at the coalface is how best to judge that a person is ready to have these conversations. And we don't know how best to train our workforce to lead them there. Now, you might be thinking, well, that's what collaboration is for. Get the clinicians and the researchers talking. And yes, I too love a good collaboration. There is something to be said, though, for people with a foot simultaneously in both camps. Double agents who have a well-established set of connections already brokered on either side. Clinician researchers have the insider knowledge you need to effectively decode and translate the language each group uses, to quickly spot barriers and paths to implementation, and crucially, to achieve the health system buy-in you need to actually bring the science into being. This adds efficiency to the system. As an investment, you could argue that you're getting more bang for your buck. In my own research, I'm looking at the science behind how we talk about end-of-life concepts with young people. We're conducting early phase research to pick apart how young people approach thinking about these concepts and the implications of this for how we facilitate these conversations in practice, for example, with a 20-year-old dying from cancer. My role as a clinical psychologist means that I'm constantly applying what we learn in research to tweak and improve our patient care in real time. Recent data show that we spend a lot of our research dollars at the lab science end of things. And without doubt, we do need a lot of time, funding, and lab scientists to refine, for example, how chemotherapies are selected for patients with rare cancers. But it's important to note that when you ask patients and consumers what they value in research, they overwhelmingly prioritise research that focuses on testing treatments in the real world, the translational stuff. In Australia, we don't currently have any single clear path to becoming a clinician researcher, not in medicine and not in other health professions. There is hope, though. A recent national report, the McKeon Review, highlighted the need for more clinician researchers. They argued that to ensure better health outcomes for Australians, research needs to become fundamentally embedded within healthcare delivery. Then, when Australia's National Health and Medical Research Council drastically overhauled their entire funding model back in 2017, research fellowships for active clinicians were a core piece of the puzzle. Both here and overseas, universities have also started grappling with the supremely challenging task of how to demonstrate the value and impact of this messier, translational sort of research. This is encouraging because I think we do need to do better at integrating research into our clinical work and enabling clinicians to actively lead research agendas. At a societal level, I think this also involves us diversifying how we view scientists doing science. Right now, in 2019, if you Google picture of a scientist, you will be inundated with shiny stock photos of people, mostly white, often men, in white lab coats. They are holding mysterious green chemicals and steaming beakers or peering intensely at DNA test results on a computer screen. And there's one last crucial reason that you might want your doctor or dietitian, psychologist or social worker to have their hand in guiding what research actually gets done. These are the people supporting and listening to you, the patient. When medicines or psychological strategies that you've been prescribed don't work for you, talking to your health provider about it is a potential fast track to something new being studied and changed. A clinician researcher is primed and ready to integrate the patient voice into research from the ground up. Back in 2015, I was so lucky to welcome a beautiful baby boy into the world. about a month ahead of schedule. Neither my clinician nor my researcher hats could have prepared me for the utterly unsettling experience of trying to navigate six different sets of information dispensed over the course of 5 days in a neonatal intensive care unit by about four different professions, all doing their absolute best, but possibly not talking to each other as much as they should, all whilst advocating for our precious 2.8 kilo newborn. And of course, I'm not alone. We've all been a patient sometime or another, whether waiting for immunizations at a GP's practice or waiting to go into surgery for a cancerous tumor. So the idea of our needs and experiences shaping what is studied and how healthcare is delivered is something I think we can all get behind. As clinicians and researchers, taxpayers and carers, current and future patients, we need to push for clinician researchers to have more space at the table to improve this deal for all of us.
Yes, for all of us, including leading medics like Dr. Ursula Sampson-Daly, speaking there at the Powerhouse Museum. She's at the University of New South Wales. I'm Robin Williams.
G'day, I'm Anne Jones, and if you enjoyed that podcast, there are more ABC science podcasts like mine, Off Track. It's just like David Attenborough, but for your ears. Search for Off Track in the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.